Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Pat Morgan. Pat is an expert on homelessness. She received a presidential appointment to the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, a working group of the White House domestic policy under President Bill Clinton. Pat and I will be discussing her latest book, The Concrete Killing Fields. Good morning, Pat. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. It is great to have you on the air with me this morning. It's a pleasure reading your book. The Concrete Killing Fields is an insightful book. It is a difficult book to read at times because it truly engages one's emotion. However, I must say it should be a necessary read for everyone. It's wonderfully written. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay, I was, I'm born and bred a Southerner. I was one of five children, the middle kid of four girls and one boy. The firstborn daughter died before any of the rest of us was born. She was only 18 months old. But I grew up and graduated from high school in a tiny segregated town in Arkansas, population 543. Mm-hmm. It was a few miles from Memphis, still is, of course, in the Mississippi River. And we grew up poor, but since everybody else in the town was poor too, that wasn't a major factor. The major factor was that I was about five when my mother got on a bus to go shopping in Memphis one day and never came back. So my dad remarried pretty quickly because he had four kids to raise by himself. And high school was not a major thing or going to school. I was always one of the popular kids and did well in school. But I was about 14 when she called and told me that, well, basically I had an opportunity to reconnect with her, and I just blew it. She said, Pat, this is your mother. And I was sitting there looking at my stepmother, who had many good qualities but was also the most jealous woman I've ever known. And I said, I'm sorry, my mother's sitting at the dining room table. And my birth mother hung up, and I, you know, caller ID hadn't been invented.
Yeah.
It was, there was no way to find her. But I had dreamed and longed for her all those years. And then in, you know, one callous, cool moment, I had blown it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That fall, my stepbrother died in Korea, which, of course, took effect, you know, had its effect. And then the year I graduated from high school, my mother killed herself. And then a year to the day later, my father, who was a deputy sheriff, was shot and killed in the line of duty. So before I turned 19, I had lost my stepbrother, my mother, my birth mother twice. My stepmother immediately left and remarried and left, and my father. So it was a very trying period. But I've always been a very resilient person. I've always moved ahead with my life. But I don't think I even knew how wounded I was. But after my father was killed, I quickly married my high school sweetheart, even though he had jilted me, married somebody else, and wasn't quite divorced when we started dating because he was there for me when my dad was killed.
Yeah.
We had three wonderful sons, you know. So I got into banking, worked at a bank for 12 years, raised my sons, and then alcoholism, my husband's alcoholism and my codependency doomed that marriage. But so I got divorced, I think, to preserve my own sanity and health. But then it freed me. I was all of a sudden, from that smothering marriage, I was free to live my life the way I'd always wanted to do, to reach out to people, to be social, to love life.
Yeah.
I had went into real estate and then got into politics and even got myself elected to county government. Raised a lot of cane there when I saw that the how the money was being spent.
Yeah.
Made a lot of enemies, made a lot of friends, but then I ran for state representative and then I ran for county judge and I lost both of those that I should have because I ran for the wrong reason on the state representative. I think part of it is I wanted to go to Little Rock and party with the state's movers and shakers, and then the last one I ran to get even. That's never a good policy for running for office. I wanted to tell everything I knew, and I did that, and I wasn't at all unhappy when I lost that one. So at any rate, then I remarried and moved to Memphis to try to salvage that marriage, which I say in the book was doomed from the minute we both said I do, and then neither one of us did. I had run for county judge, you know, while during what should have been my honeymoon period.
Oh, no.
And, I mean, not an auspicious way to start a marriage. And he had only been dry. He was a recovering alcoholic, but he had only been dry for a year. So basically, you know, we're talking about a dry drunk, and I didn't know.
Yeah.
I still didn't know enough about it. But we moved to Memphis to salvage that marriage. And immediately I started looking for a church home because I've been a fixture in church my whole life. And I found Calvary Episcopal Church in downtown Memphis very quickly because they had a sign out front that said Criminal Justice Ministry. And I wanted to be able to help people.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a perfect place for me to be, and actually it was. So within a year, the rector of the priest had asked for people to come in and help with the street people, we call them, who were coming in off the street asking for help. And the first day I walked in, I was just totally hooked. I mean, I was going to do 2 hours one afternoon a week, and I was hooked that first day. So I would try to sell real estate in the morning, and then I'd be at the church with the street people. And I just absolutely loved it. So wound up very quickly being the director and developer of that program as a volunteer. And I did that for 5 years, and all the time we were trying to help homeless people, I was also trying to work to make the system, you know, to connect with the system because we couldn't get people into the treatment programs. We couldn't get them into the mental health system. So I was doing a lot of advocacy with that. So I did that for 5 years. By that time, the marriage had dissolved, which, you know, probably should have anyway. But at any rate, I didn't like being a two-time loser, but we were not compatible. But anyway, then I got an opportunity. We had reached the point where we had gotten the mental health centers to come in and work with us. We had representative payees. We had a lot of stuff that we didn't have before, but we still didn't have nearly enough. So I decided I'd go back to college. Had a perfect opportunity to do that. I was 48 when I went back, and I was still selling real estate and still doing advocacy for homeless people. And my sons then, of course, were grown and independent. So I was free. I mean, I was free to do what I wanted to do with my life, which was pretty cool. So I did that, went back to college, and my political science mentor nominated me for one of Time Magazine's awards. And it was, and I, out of 500 nominations, I was one of 20 outstanding college juniors in America. I was 50 years old by then. They called us rising stars. Well, I'm over the hill but on a roll, you know. So that opened a lot of doors, too. And then when he also suggested that I do a Washington semester in American politics at American University. So I did that and interned in Al Gore's office. I already knew him because I'd been out politicking for him when he was running for the nomination for president in 88. And then I had known Bill Clinton and been a fixture on the podium with him or in the crowd every year that he was running. And then when Bill Clinton announced he was running for president, I jumped on the campaign, worked on the campaign in the Washington Operations Office, then into the presidential transition, and set up the whole correspondence office, and then went straight from there as a presidential appointee A staff member, I need to correct my bio on that, as a staff member at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, which was a working group of the White House Domestic Policy Council, doing exactly what I had gone to Washington to do.
Because all
the advocates were talking about housing, 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 and the people I was trying to help had been thrown out of every house in town and most of the shelters. So it was the substance abuse and the mental illness, and the learning disabilities and all those things that were the causes of homelessness for the people I was seeing. And,
right.
you know, I'd been in real estate. How are you going to be in housing when you have no money?
Right,
so it was,
right.
It was a combination of those things. So that just sent, so I did that until the ending of the, well, as soon as Bill Clinton was, or whatever it was that the Supreme, that the Senate, okay, they didn't convict him of,
impeachment,
they didn't
yeah.
go, mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. they didn't mm-hmm. convict him on that. And as soon as that was over, I came back home because I was ready to come home. I had grandchildren by then. And so I came back and immediately jumped into working again on homelessness here in Memphis, but on a different level. I was the executive director of Partners for the Homeless for 12 years, and we were working to coordinate and develop all the programs for homeless people here in Memphis.
Then
4 years ago, I resigned from that to really finish my book. It had moved from being something I always wanted to do to being on my bucket list. It was time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent the next couple of years really finishing that up, and then a year on the publishing part. So, and now I'm spending every minute of every day almost, you know, with the marketing part.
Right.
Everybody
right.
told me that'd be the hard work, and they're right, it is.
Welcome to the author's wall.
Yes. Yeah, you understand very, very well. Sure. In
That's
fact,
fantastic.
I'm looking forward to reading your books. I checked your website out. It's very, very impressive.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Pat, you had such a wonderful story. When reading your book and now hearing a quick snapshot of your life, I have to say this. It's amazing how we're put in this world and we have to take this little journey that sort of equips us each time when we go through different things in life, because then when you speak, whatever work you're doing right now, you are actually an experiential speaker, leader, coach, and counselor. And that's fascinating. It's not necessarily someone that just read tons of book and use books as references, because you have been there. You've done that. You've been on the pavement. You've been walking and doing different things. And that brings me to my next question. Over the years, looking back, the things that you have encountered and so forth, what life's epiphanies have to shape you to be the person you are today?
Well, I think, you know, people say that that does not destroy us makes us stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think surviving all those losses, you know, gave me real insight into what's happening with homeless people.
Yeah.
But then the other part was when I walked into the Great Hall of the church that day, and here were all 10 or 12 of the sickest, most ragged people I had ever seen. And I knew a lot about poverty. I'd lived some of it myself.
Yeah.
But that was it just changed me. I mean, I was hooked. And I tell people, I almost called the book The Call from the Concrete Killing Fields, because I was called. I have been called, okay? And when you answer that call, you're... life just takes on a whole new measure. But
right.
it also led to the healing.
Right.
Okay, an enormous amount of healing through all these experiences. Okay, because even with Alopecia, my central character, it was when he told me what the voices said to him that I really got in touch with how profoundly I had hurt my mother and how I had contributed in some way to her death.
Mm-hmm.
I had totally destroyed any hope that she had of reconciling with her children.
Mm-hmm.
A stronger person could have come back from that, you know, but she was very fragile, and, you know, I just didn't know anything about her. And then when I found her letters after my father was killed and realized how much she loved us, mm-hmm. and how sorry she was. It was just a monumental thing. So
right.
I've had a lot of healing out of this.
Right. That's fascinating, though, because I think we go through that journey to understand how human behavior works. And in one of the things that I talk about, what happened in any kind of relationship, and I believe in whether it's a parent, child, or even spouses and friends and so forth, people love you the best way they know how. That's giving the fact that they do love you and they try their best to love you, but they love you the best way they know how.
I agree with that. I've been saying it in a little different way for mm-hmm. years. She did the best she could with what she had at the time.
That's correct.
She
That's
was
correct.
Very fragile. She had been sexually abused by her father.
Mm-hmm.
She had. She was only 14 when she had her first baby.
Yeah.
I mean, by the
yeah.
time she was 22, she had 5 children.
Wow.
She was just, and everybody yeah. that I met later who knew her said mm-hmm. that she was very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was an orphan when he was 6.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he did the best he could with what he had.
Precisely.
You know?
Precisely.
And I've done the best I could with what I have.
Right. Right.
Know? And you have too.
Right.
And I guess that's the answer to a happy life. You know.
That's right.
You know,
that's
you
right.
did the best you could with what you had at the time.
Right. You can measure yourself with others using their measuring tape. You have to measure yourself using your own measuring tape.
That's what I tell people, too. I said, when we talk about how different we are, I'm very, very liberal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm conservative about the money. Don't spend the money crazy, okay?
Right.
But I'm very liberal, particularly on all the
yeah.
social issues. But then
right.
the people who are conservative and they don't want to spend any money to help poor people,
right.
I made it and they can, too.
Right.
You know, they're forgetting that we're not all blessed with the same families,
Precisely.
With the same level of intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
The same level of resilience, you know.
Right, right.
You know, I just think it's so arrogant to think everybody's supposed to be like me.
Right, right. That's
They're
true.
Not.
With that, please give us an update on the current state of homelessness in the United States.
We've come a long, long way. When we did the first count,
mm-hmm.
when the Census Bureau did the first count back in 1985, I think,
mm-hmm.
There were like 750,000 people that they found. And there was a big fight about that because the other people were saying it was 3 million. But
yeah.
the difference is that there's a number for the number who are homeless at a point in time. That's
right.
the lower figure. The higher figure is the number who are homeless over the course of a year.
Mm-hmm.
So from 750,000 back then, it's down to 610,000 now. Okay? The
yeah,
last point
yeah.
in time count. Well, 2013, they haven't issued the numbers for 2014. It's down to 610,000, and the number over a course of a year is about twice that number. So the
yeah.
numbers are down. But you still have all these homeless people out on the streets, which
right.
that makes you think it's not down.
Right.
My major concern, there's so much that's going on, particularly really good stuff. Like we're doing a much, much, much better job with veterans. And back
mm-hmm.
in the 80s, we were doing an abysmal job helping the Vietnam veterans, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So much, much better with veterans. And I think we've seen some unprecedented cooperation from the different departments of the federal government, like the Veterans Administration and HUD are working together.
Right.
Health and Human Services is working together. With HUD, you know, they're putting the housing and the services together. My major concern is that we are right back to the national advocates and the government are back to saying it's all about housing. And it's not all about housing, okay? Housing is the last thing people lose before they become homeless. My mantra over all these years has been the fact that a man or a woman, especially if they're unaccompanied by children, the fact that he or she doesn't have a house, an apartment, a room, a bed, a job, any form of transportation, any money in their pockets,
yeah.
and not one single family member or friend who can or will take them in for one more night.
Yeah.
That's not the problem. Why he or she has none of the above? That's the problem. The others are symptoms of the problem. And if
That's
we
right.
don't deal with the basic issue that's there, they're more likely to become homeless over and over, or their children are going to become homeless, or we're going to continue to have masses of people who really need mental health and substance abuse treatment, who really need friends and family. And we're going to end homelessness when we break the cycle of domestic violence, child abuse, illiteracy, poverty. That's when we'll break. That's when we'll end homelessness. And we waste up, you know, like Alapeachy. We helped him get everything but a life.
Right, right.
You know, and he got the meds, so he didn't hear the voices anymore. But as he told me, he said, "My life is so empty, I still want to kill myself." So we're, you know, but we've got to talk about the mental health system and how, you know, with all the school shootings, with everything that's been happening over the years, and historically, mental health comes to the forefront after wars because people are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder. Then you look at the numbers who couldn't get into the service, who couldn't even couldn't have been drafted back in the olden days, because of the substance abuse, the learning disabilities, the mental illnesses that aren't being treated. So, I mean, I think we've just got, I'm back on my soapbox now about the mental health piece. And I'm back, and I don't do the party line, I'm sorry.
But
that's my experience, and that's what I see, and that's what the numbers tell me, too.
Well, you have the inside information, the data that backs that up, and it's very true, because what happens here is that you have situations where these people are falling into the cracks and out in society, and then from a perspective of the general public, when we run into a homeless person, I personally will be the first one to tell you, I mean, I'm apprehensive. I end up giving people money, but I am apprehensive because I'm not sure how they would react.
You know, in all the years, the 30 years that I've been working with homeless people, I have never been hurt or even threatened by one. And that may be because I'm not afraid of them. We grew up in a segregated, archly segregated society. But we lived on the wrong side of the tracks.
I mean,
there were, in a town of 543 people, you were close anyway. But we lived over in the poorer area. And so we knew people as people. And I think most of the people in town did. We knew people as people. So when I got into homelessness, and the vast majority of them, 80 to 90% of the people we were dealing with were African Americans, people would say, "Aren't you afraid?" And I said, "Well, no."
I
mean, I've known people my whole life, you know, and they're just, you know, it's the color of somebody's skin. It doesn't change who we are. But anyway, but that fear factor is there. But what I do, and I have bought every story that's ever been told. I've been conned by the best and the worst, at least twice, okay? But I have learned through experience not to give cash to people on the street who are asking me for it, okay?
Interesting.
Okay.
It
will, and I know the Bible says give to those who ask you, you know, don't turn anybody away. But I don't think Jesus meant for somebody to give somebody a loaded gun when they were suicidal.
Gotcha.
Okay?
So
you don't give somebody something that's going to hurt them or that's going to continue to enable their self-destructive pattern of life. If someone asked me for food, I'd say, "Come on, I'll buy you something," okay?
Gotcha.
And if they don't want a hot dog, they want KFC, I think they're not very hungry. If they won't take the hot dog or the sandwich from the Subway because they want KFC, they're not that hungry. Or if they just want the money so they can go get it, I don't do that. Yeah. I will either take them in and buy them something to eat, or I will buy it and bring it to them.
I've
also learned to do, in Memphis, I knew every resource, and I knew exactly who did what on what, you know, a given day, so I could screen a request very quickly just by asking a few questions. When I went to Washington, I didn't have those resources. I didn't know the system. I didn't know. And I didn't have the time to stop and screen it. I was busy trying to stay alive or get somebody elected or working 18 hours a day in the administration. But But what I did learn to say is I just look at them, I acknowledge them with a nice look, and just say, I wish I could. Mm-hmm. I wish I could covers a lot of territory.
Yeah.
I do wish I could. I wish I could hand them what they ask for. I wish it would be used for what they say they're going to use it for. I wish it would really help them. I wish I could give it to them so I wouldn't feel guilty because I didn't. Covers a lot of territory. And I have yet to have one person question it. And I've told other people about it and about how to do that. And they come back and they say, it works. I say, yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. Because the homeless people, if they're truly homeless, they understand. They know why they're homeless.
Yeah.
They know what they're going to do with it. Now, aggressive panhandlers, I just, you know, if they're shouting at me and following me down the street,
I
just say, I wish I could, you know, I might not be compassionate to them, but that's it, and or just walk away. But that way, you don't give somebody something that's going to hurt them. And then if you feel guilty about it, go make a donation to a program that you know is really working to help them.
Yeah.
And that, you know, then that covers that part of it. And it's better for them, too.
Right. These are wonderful tips, though, because I think people are put in a position where, I mean, I have a soft heart, and I'm in a situation, well, what am I going to do here? And then when I say no, and I don't care what people say, we're all, in some ways, we size things up, we're judgmental subconsciously and whatnot, and because when you get caught in a situation in the moment, you're going to see, and then you're going to make a quick assessment. And that's when you say yes or no. So in a situation sometimes like that, and then when you say no, and then I feel so guilty afterwards. And it's very, very tough.
Well, try just saying, I wish I could.
No, I appreciate that. It's true, because sometimes you can help in so many different ways that these people don't even know it. And that's not the whole conversation. I don't want to get drawn out into that in terms of, you know, I know that there are wonderful, wonderful people that are on the streets because of unfortunate circumstances. And I want to talk about that because you covered so many of these people in the book in honoring them, and so you're doing such a fantastic work with that. Why did you decide to write The Concrete Killing Fields?
I have always loved to write. I've always loved to meet. There are people who write because they, you know, have to, and they're for their schoolwork or something. I've just always loved it, okay? And I had won I think that probably contributed to my getting that one-year scholarship, you know, for my first year in college. And I just love writing. But what made me, and I always wanted to write a book. I just didn't know what I was going to write a book about.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started working with homeless people, and especially after we lost our first one, after Arthur, and this is a cliche, but I vowed that his death would not be in vain. He was the first one we lost to the concrete killing fields, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just swore to myself that people would know who he was and that his life mattered just as much as anybody else's.
Yeah.
And I wanted people to know why he was homeless. He didn't choose. Nobody ever got up in the morning and said, I think I want to be an alcoholic when I grow up, you know.
Yeah.
There's use of the drug, there's abuse, there's use, misuse, abuse, and addiction. And nobody explained addiction better to me than Applejack, who told me one day after I had dragged him out of a dumpster, you know.
Yeah,
and I said,
yeah.
Why do you drink so much? And he could pour more alcohol down his gullet than anybody I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's like an itch. It's like the worst itch you ever had in your life, but the itch goes from the bottom of your feet to the top of your head, and there ain't nothing in the world but you and that itch, and there ain't nothing you won't do to scratch it.
Mm-hmm.
And that explained addiction to me better than any professional had ever done, okay?
Yeah.
If you've ever had poison oak, you know what I mean. Okay, because you know, I've had it, and I almost tore my arm off. So, but nobody, I mean, people don't get into that level of addiction. And mental illness sneaks up on people, and we have to remember that depression looks just like laziness.
Yeah.
Clinical depression looks just like laziness. People don't want to get out of bed. They don't want to do anything. They don't want to go to work. And so what we have learned over the years is how often clinical depression underlies that misuse and abuse and addiction to alcohol and other drugs. So it's always there. So it's not, when I talk about mental illness and substance abuse, it's not a blaming, judging, condemning thing. It's not a justification. It's an explanation for what's happening. And until we deal with that and its effects on the family and on the friends, because once that gets in there, when you don't have one family member or friend that you can call on, something is basically amiss. You've either worn out your welcome everywhere, or you didn't have it to begin with. Maybe they were so isolated they didn't feel that they had a friend that they could call on. Or the family of origin was so dysfunctional they're better off not to go home.
That's right.
I want to mention, too, that homelessness is very different for families with children.
Mm-hmm.
We do not see anywhere near the level of mental illness and substance abuse among the families. Of course, the children are different, but many of the children have major health issues, developmental issues, and many of the women have a lot of depression, but it's not the kind of that would send you off. Frankly, the ones who are the sickest have already lost their children. They've already lost their children to family members of the foster care system. But for a lot of them, housing is key. I don't want to take anything away from the housing piece. Nothing works without housing. You cannot end homelessness without housing. Okay, but you've got to have the other pieces too.
Right. That's true. Very true. What is the greatest challenge in writing the book?
I think for me it was, I knew what I wanted people to know, what I wanted to tell them. I wanted to help people understand homelessness as I understood it, and balancing that between what people really want to read. I had first written it with just, it was almost like a collection of essays and stories about each one of the homeless people and why they were homeless and how we reacted to them and how we tried to help them and what happened. But that didn't, it wasn't a marketable concept. It didn't draw people's attention and keep it for a sustained, it didn't make them want to turn the page to the next one.
So
going back, and then when I went back, and I tried to keep myself out of it as much as I could that first time. I wanted to write about them. But then when I started rewriting it, then more of my story, and because it, frankly, just kind of opened my mind more to how profoundly they had affected my life.
Right.
And then pulling all that up and going through all the things that I went through with my healing process. And it was, you know, it was a very therapeutic thing to do, but it was very difficult to do.
Right.
But it freed me, you know. The truth shall make us free.
The book is beautifully written, and I could say this much. Two things that I would always look in terms of reading a book, I can look it through the lens of love. I mean, something that I want to learn from it and so forth. Or through the lens of fear, something that I want to know that will help me understand fear. Both of those questions are answered in reading the book in the sense that you get information out of it. If you are a loving person by nature and you want to know what causes these people to be homeless, the plight of the homelessness and so forth, then this book is for you. And then on the other hand, if you are the people that, oh my God, I want to stay away from these people, quote unquote, pick up this book too. You'd be surprised, because then you realize that they're no different than you are in so many ways, and they have a lot to offer in terms of the street wisdom that they have encountered in their lives. And perhaps, hopefully, it adds flavor to your life in understanding how they live their life, because we all need that balancing act in our lives.
One of the reasons I chose the cover for the book is, and that's not an egotistical thing, because you can't tell at me because I'm pretty dumpy, but that is me at 3 a.m. under the overpass on 3rd Street looking at these homeless men and women rolled up in blankets, I say like human hot dogs.
Yeah.
Sleeping outdoors like that in the dead of winter.
Yeah.
And I don't know how anybody can go out and see that and not be changed.
So that's right.
While they're learning from us, we are also learning from them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they changed my life. I mean, had I not gotten into homelessness, I've literally lived out my dreams.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, you have to be careful when you say, okay, God, wherever you want me to go and whatever you want me to do, I'll do it, even if I don't want to.
Yeah.
You know, I went places and did things I never dreamed I would get to do. So, you know, these experiences can be, you know, life-altering.
Right.
I mean, I look up one day and I'm sitting in the president's box at the Kennedy Center. A girl from Turl, Arkansas. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And just because you follow your dreams and you follow,
right.
you know, you answer your call to do whatever it is you're supposed to do with this life.
Well, the most important thing for me is that you have an opportunity to really understand the world, to share something with you. I think it's about three Christmases ago. I was involved with an organization or a group, a social group, and this lady was originally from California. And what's
mm-hmm.
interesting about what she does is that once a year during Christmas, she'll get all of us clean our closet, basically, for jackets
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And this is in Dallas now. She lives in Frisco,
mm-hmm.
Texas, which is just north of Dallas. And that one year that I was kind of actively involved with the organization, I volunteered my time on Christmas Day. What we do is that we got together, we
mm-hmm.
went downtown, and she's a pro at this. As we drove around, and there were three cars total because we have that many jackets and coats and whatnot to give away.
Mm-hmm.
She knew how to spot the homeless. And we would get out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and she just pulls out there and say, hey, I've got a jacket for you. Merry Christmas. I've got this for you. I've got that. We gave a few ladies some jackets, and we gave some men. It was a very rewarding experience for me in the sense that you talk about ordinary people, but they happen to be homeless.
Yeah, they get just as cold as we do.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a wonderful experience.
They get just as cold and hungry as we do.
Yeah. Lo and behold, 3 years afterwards, I'm here on the air speaking with you about this whole thing. So that's fantastic.
Because it meant something to you, and it stuck with you.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah. And we treasure what the volunteers come in and do during the holidays. Because then those of us who've been hoofing it for 360 days get
yeah,
a rest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we do. I mean, there's so many things that people can do. I mean, it
right.
can be something like giving somebody a coat.
Yeah.
I want to mention something. Sometimes,
sure.
sometimes the people who are sitting out there that never ask anybody for anything, you know, they just sit there. You see them day in and day out just sitting there. They may well be schizophrenic, so they don't trust you. They don't
right.
ask you for anything because they don't trust you.
Right.
Okay? But the other thing is I'm still pretty bad about that. If I'm trying to engage someone, I may slip a couple of dollars in their pocket.
Yeah.
And I had one man, this is about 3 years ago, and I'd been doing this for some time. And so when I finally got him in to have him involuntarily committed, which took an act of God,
mm-hmm.
it's almost impossible to get anybody involuntarily committed. But it was 22 degrees, and the sole had fallen off his shoe, and he was still sitting outside where he'd been sitting for 9 years. But anyway, when they took him to the hospital, he had $3,400 on his person.
Wow.
Under all those layers of clothes, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He wound up losing his feet because he had, I couldn't get him in. I could not get him voluntarily committed in time to keep him from getting frostbite. So his toes
right.
fell off, and then he went back out, and then he had to have his feet amputated.
Yeah.
And that's the mental health piece. You know, we should be able to get these folks when it's 22 degrees and they're sitting there with no clothes on. We ought to be able to get them involuntarily
right.
committed for their own health.
Right, right.
So I'm grateful for anything anybody does.
One of the stories in the book that I kind of wanted to talk about is the homeless person, Joe. I know there are other veterans in the book, and I guess what I'm looking for, I guess, to get information here is that are there that many veterans out there that are like him?
There are far more veterans than the percentage in the population.
Because mm-hmm.
what happens is that, you know, and there's this is not that much. It's very different these days in some ways and much the same in others. So many of the folks who are coming back now have the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
Okay, but they had it back after Vietnam, too. what we're seeing now, too, is the brain injuries from these IEDs, you know, these...
Yes, yes, yes.
All mm-hmm. these things that are exploding around them all the time, and the multiple tours of duty.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid that we are just seeing the tip of the iceberg on this, because even with the ones who've gone home to their families, if they're still suffering from the PTSD and the brain injuries, the traumatic brain injuries,
mm-hmm.
it can be a matter of time before the families can't cope with them anymore, they can't cope with the families.
Right.
So, number one, we don't have enough money, as always, or we choose not to spend it that way as a nation. But we also don't have enough psychologists and enough resources to do the kind of treatment and provide the resources we need.
Right,
so
right.
It's really scary, but there's a huge push on to make sure that veterans are housed, that there aren't any homeless veterans. And I love that fact. And, in fact, they've cut it down by, I think, 30% in the last 2 years. There's been a huge, emphasis on getting mm-hmm. to the veterans. And so mm-hmm. the vets are providing the case management and outreach and supportive services, and HUD's providing the housing dollars. But we have to get the Congress to appropriate more of each.
Right.
You know, and when you have a total gridlock, I mean, there are some things they can agree on, but unfortunately, if they put more money toward the services and the housing for the veterans, it also takes it away from the others. So, I mean, you just have to keep increasing it.
Right.
I mean, we've just got to make a stronger commitment to it and put the money there.
Right, right. There's another story I would like to talk about, and you mentioned his name, Arthur. The reason why I chose that story because him having to leave his family so that his wife can collect welfare. Is this a typical story for people that are homeless?
Well, the only reason it's not typical is because people aren't getting married anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of poor people, a lot of rich people, a lot of middle-income people aren't getting married anymore.
Yeah.
But, I think, to my knowledge, you still... If anybody in the household is working,
mm-hmm.
but you have so many women, most of the homeless women that I know of,
yeah.
there are just hardly any couples out there. It's almost always a single woman, and
mm-hmm.
in Memphis, in many areas, much disproportionately, African American women and their children.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they're not, the help is out there, and you have to keep in mind, too, that the cash award in Tennessee, it's different in different states, the cash award is about $250 a month. You can't pay rent with $250 a month.
Right, right, right.
It won't pay rent. It just won't. So what's happening, the women with their children are doubling up and tripling up with other family and friends, two
mm-hmm.
women and their
mm-hmm.
kids get in, then they're overcrowded and they have a fuss and they split. So the kids are moving around to different schools all during the school year, which is hurting them academically, not to mention being traumatizing, moving and not knowing where you're going to sleep any night. So that's
yeah.
a major part of what's happening with the families with children. But the segregation part, I tell people all the time, last year was the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, 150th anniversary. I'm 75. I'm half that old. We're not that far removed from slavery and segregation. And the
yeah.
vestiges of discrimination are still out there. In Memphis, almost every issue comes back to race. And we've come a long, long way. And everybody seems to know it, but we have so far yet to go. I mean, we just, it's going to be there until, well, maybe whatever year it is when we're going to be, when the white people are going to be the minority, and I'm a white person, and I'm going to be a minority, and that'll be fine with me. But it did have something, and what people went through, the total breakdown of the family structure. I mean, it was a mean-spirited thing to do. Arthur, his eyes were crossed half out of his head, God love him, he couldn't read and write.
Right.
You know, how many jobs is he going to have in a small rural community? And then when mechanization came in, they didn't need the cotton choppers and the cotton pickers anymore, so there's no jobs. But yet he has to leave his family, and his family was close to him because they were at his funeral. You know, so he still tried to stay close to them. He just couldn't live with them. And I'm sure the alcoholism had something to do with it, but he came to Memphis looking for work. But the breakdown of the family structure, no matter what color we are, is a major issue.
Right.
Kids need parents.
That's
true.
You ask
a homeless person, and I did this, I have assessed thousands, okay, literally thousands. You ask a homeless person about his father, you might as well be asking them about the last time they saw aliens from Mars. They have no idea. They either don't know them, they may have seen them two or three times in their life, they're in prison. That's another piece. There are 200,000 to 300,000 people with severe mental illnesses in jails and prisons in America. And many of them are there because of things that they did that were a direct result of untreated mental illness. If you put those folks back out on the street and try to deal with them. Oh, I want to mention something else when we're talking about progress.
Yeah.
3 or 4 years ago when they did the point in time count that HUD requires every other year, and it's very good and very thorough and covers the whole country. It was a brilliant move on HUD's part. And by the way, I worked for Andrew Cuomo, too, who is now the mayor of New York. But at any rate, they found 44% of the people were sleeping unsheltered, and that included families with children in some of the coldest states in the union. This time it was 35%, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a 10% decrease in the number of people sleeping on the streets, and that's always good. Because even when you get them housed, when they've been out on the streets that long, like Alopecia, he only lived for about a year after we got him housed. The damage from the concrete killing fields has already been done.
Yeah.
So they die. I mean, the average age, I mean, not many of them live past 55. So getting them in, here in Memphis, they had a major push, and they got 40 of them in, I think, in the last year or two, and five of them died in the past year. Five of the people they housed in the last year died.
Wow.
As soon as they got in housing. So, I mean, the damage is done. So we've got to get to the ones before they become chronically homeless, before they've been on the streets for a year or more, before they've been in the shelters and streets for a year or more. And to be chronically homeless, per HUD's definition, which provides the vast majority of the funding, they have to be homeless on the streets or in the shelters for a year or more and have to have a disability, a diagnosable disability. So when you've got all that, you know, you've got a recipe for an early death. So, but we've got to do a better job of making sure, this is my other pet peeve, to house people, we are taking money from the transitional housing programs. And for some of those, it's fine. If they're not doing their job, that's fine. If the families with children can get the same kind of services in regular housing, that's fine. But for those folks who are out there, and that was the vast majority of the ones I assessed, who have alcohol, drug, mental health issues, they need some transitional housing, okay? They need some recovery housing. They need time to recover before they've been out there so long that it's too late for them. You know? If they, you know, you can't live on the streets with that level of stress, eating out of garbage cans, and, you know, being attacked and all that stuff, you don't survive. So we've got to do, we cannot continue to close the transitional housing programs that people really need. That's prevention of chronic homelessness.
Yeah.
So we're killing up the prevention part. I went back to college and went off on my, what I call my wildly improbable journey, because I said, we can only fish so many bodies out of this river that I call homelessness, okay?
Yeah.
Some of us have to go upstream and see who's throwing the bodies in. So prevention has got to be a part of any factor, okay? It's got to be part of any strategy. And that prevention doesn't mean just paying somebody's rent. It means making sure that they get the health, mental health, and substance abuse treatment that they need.
Yeah.
If they're willing to accept it. And that's another issue, of course.
How much of the local government do you think needs to be involved with something like this?
A lot more than they are. A few are very, very involved, okay?
Yeah.
But the issue and the reality is, okay, cities have to balance their budget.
Right.
States have to balance their budget. They are required to balance their budget, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or they have to have some reserves to cover it. The
yeah.
federal government does not have to balance its budget.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge push to dump the cost from... The feds have already picked up a vast majority of the funding for mental illness, substance
mm-hmm.
abuse treatment, homelessness. They've already picked it up. They're trying to stuff it back on the states, and the states then are trying to stuff it back on the cities and the counties. Okay? But county judges and county sheriffs all over the country are bemoaning the fact that there's so many people in their jails who don't need to be there because they should have been getting treatment in the regular
yeah.
system. But once you go into jail, the feds won't pay for it, and the states won't pay for it. So then the local government has to pick it up.
I see.
So you've
I
got
see.
all these folks in jail. And then you have the advocates that they call themselves the purists who say,
mm-hmm,
I have
mm-hmm.
the absolute right to my freedom.
Yeah,
you also
yeah.
have the right to be incarcerated for being sick.
Right, right.
So
right.
where do we draw the line?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Fuller Torrey, who is the prime advocate for the right to
yeah.
treatment in the country and has founded the Treatment Advocacy Center and has written a boatload of books about homeless, mentally ill people. And he was the psychologist, chief of staff at St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C. when deinstitutionalization came about. So he saw his patients go from what people called a snake pit to the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So now
mm-hmm.
they're out in front of the streets. You know, they're out in front of the White House,
yeah.
in the parks, living like subhumans. You know,
yeah,
I mean, there was an easier way to do that. You know, put the money
right.
where it should have gone. But
right.
he says it's almost impossible to get somebody involuntarily committed, and it
yeah.
is. I mean, I know from personal experience because I've tried to get them in there.
Right.
And we've
right.
got to do something. So what they're talking about now, and what I'm pushing too, is
mm-hmm.
assisted outpatient treatment. Okay, and
mm-hmm.
you catch them
mm-hmm.
before they go to jail.
Okay, yeah,
yeah. You've messed up again, but it's because you were sick and you weren't taking your meds. Now, they're going to put you in jail, okay, unless you start taking your meds. And is that coercion? Yes. Does it beat being in prison or jail? Yes. So, but you have to put the money with it. You have to put
yeah.
the money with it. And many states, in fact, Tennessee is one of only five states that hasn't passed a law saying, some statute
mm-hmm.
that would allow assisted outpatient treatment.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to pass it, and many of the advocates don't want to pass it because they say it's not working in other states.
Right, right.
It's not working because you didn't put the money with it.
Mm-hmm.
So if
mm-hmm.
you ask them, would it work if you put the money with it, they say, oh, yes. So I'm proposing here in Memphis, and you know, as soon as I get time, I'll really be pushing on it. We have, I believe in our city government, I believe in our county government, I believe in the State Department of Mental Health, I believe in our local providers, and Memphis is a very generous city. Our foundations are phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And if we put money in from all five of those sources, then I think we can make it work. So I'm very much a believer in a public-private partnership, because
mm-hmm.
that's the program that I ran, Partners for the Homeless, was a public-private partnership. We got funding from the city, the county, the feds, and private foundations, and it worked. You know, everybody had a piece of it,
mm-hmm.
and it worked.
That sounds fascinating. One of the things that you covered in the book, this is, of course, it's related to Tennessee. You mentioned the state of Tennessee, is the Tennessee Preparatory School, and I thought that was very interesting where they have a very nice name. But what they do is, it's fascinating, is so wonderful. So tell us a little bit about the history of the Tennessee Preparatory School.
Well, it was founded by a man who lost his son in a train accident. And they had been trying to get the state, this was way back in the, I think of the 1800s, I've forgotten now.
Yes.
But at any rate, he founded it when his son was killed, and he just turned all of his property over to the, you know, and he actually built the Tennessee, he turned it into the Tennessee Preparatory School, and it was after yellow fever and all that stuff, so they had to have a home, but it was a home for abused, neglected, and orphaned children. And it worked really, really well for a long time. But then I think what happened is then the state had it and didn't fund it properly. And then the whole piece about, I don't know, and I mentioned this in the book, I don't know how many times or if Alapeachy's family ever tried to get him back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Alapeachy told his case manager, and I just learned this not long ago, he told his case manager that his parents gave him, his mother gave him to a woman down the street so she could get a check.
Yeah.
I mean, just turned over his life to someone else, which of course would mean why he didn't feel like he was wanted.
Right.
But at any
right.
rate, after I think it was in there for several decades, but the people who went to that school have a group, and they still, even after it's been closed down for 15 years, they still have this thing with very fond memories of being there. They had a football team, a basketball team, JC, young JCs, all kinds of things. The killing thing was that they had homecoming and prom and all that stuff, but there were no parents there to take them home at the end of
right.
the day.
Right,
they all
right.
lived there. And
right.
Alapeachy, as best I can tell, his photo was not in that year. They had a yearbook that was, you would never have known that it was a yearbook for orphaned, abused, and neglected kids. It was exactly the same as any yearbook I've ever seen, you know, kids playing and having all that kind of stuff. But to be there and never have your parents or your family be there for him. And then when he came out, he was not in the graduating class where I expected to find him, because he was in the honor roll in sixth or seventh grade, and then he was president of his eighth grade class, and he looked fine, you know. But but I think coming out too at 18, and he joined the Army, and then he was only in for 3 weeks. So even the Army didn't want him. So who wanted him? So no wonder.
Yeah.
No wonder the voices told him nobody wants you, everybody hates you, you know, why don't you die?
Yeah, right.
So just totally lost. And he might have been okay, I don't know, maybe that was about the time he was exhibiting symptoms of the schizophrenia, who knows?
Yeah. It's a fascinating story, you have a wonderful book. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Oh, absolutely. I gave this some thought. And I think, frankly, the 12 steps that you have in these 12-step recovery programs.
Yes.
I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't a sexaholic. I wasn't a foodaholic or any of that stuff. But I decided that I needed a 12-step program, because those 12 steps cause you to look at yourself, to examine your own life, to look at how you've hurt other people, to forgive yourself, to forgive other people. You know, and it's a freeing thing where you go on. And then the serenity prayer is, that's the recipe. And that serenity prayer is, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And then I added another piece, because it wasn't enough for me to know what I needed to do or not. I added, and the self-discipline to act or not act based on that understanding. So if you go back and look at any 12-step program, you can find something there that really pertains to all of us. And I think that's probably as close as I can get to a recipe, with a whole big dash of love and kindness and forgiveness of oneself and others.
It's just beautiful, Pat. Thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Shelley Gitlow. She is the co-writer of the feature film Boynton Beach Club. Shelley and I will be discussing her funny debut novel, Dispatches from Paradise. The novel takes readers to the family battlefield of three generations of women living together in the sultry city of Miami. This will be a special Mother's Day broadcast. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Pat, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.